NPR will have live coverage today when President Trump announces his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. That's at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time. On Insight, I'll talk with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, about the judges who seem to be the leading candidates. We'll also discuss the selection process. Then, reaction from Congresswoman Doris Matsui to Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire from the High Court. Her family and the Kennedys share roots in Sacramento, and she came by last week to talk with me about that and many more topics. So you'll hear that conversation. In our second half hour, an update from CAL FIRE as some of the big wildfires are contained, others are still raging. And later, author Suzanne Rendell, she's from Sacramento. She wrote The Other Typist, and she has a new mystery titled Eagle and Crane, set in the early 1940s in Newcastle. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. President Trump says he hasn't made his final decision yet, but by this evening, he does plan to announce his choice to replace U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. NPR's live coverage of the news will be carried on Cap Radio and at capradio.org starting at 6 p.m. Pacific time. This whole process, as you may know, was set into motion when Justice Kennedy announced his retirement on June 27th. He is 81 years old. He's been on the bench nearly 30 years, and he's from Sacramento. The political junkie Ken Rudin is standing by for our weekly conversation, and my oh my, there is a lot to discuss. Hello, Ken, and happy Monday.
Thank you, Beth. Happy Monday, and absolutely a lot to discuss. This is a big appointment, no matter whom President Trump picks.
Well, because of the holiday week last week, you and I haven't even talked about Justice Kennedy's announcement. There had been rumors, but when it became real, there was reaction as if this was a seismic event. Maybe not so much in Justice Kennedy retiring, but in what's coming ahead of us now.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we've known for a long time, or at least it's been rumored for a long time, that Kennedy was thinking about retiring. That goes back at least a year or two. And of course, we were always kind of expecting it to happen. But once it did happen, it is seismic. And the fact that the reason it's seismic is that even though Justice Kennedy is conservative, he was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He's voted mostly with the conservatives. Certainly this court term, he's voted with the conservatives. But at the same time, he's also cast some key votes in favor of same-sex marriage, affirmative action, abortion rights, things like that. So no matter who, as I say, whoever Trump picks tonight, this nominee will be further to the right than Justice Kennedy, moving the court further to the right. And suddenly, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, and now he seems to be the swing judge in the fact that you're going to have four way to the right of him, four way to the left of him. Almost Roberts becomes that swing justice, even though he, too, is very conservative.
Right. How interesting is that, Ken? Wow. I do want to get to the names that are being talked about. There was a list right away, and this list goes back to before Justice Neil Gorsuch was chosen. We can talk about the evolution, the creation of that list, but it seems that there are four major names today. Four people had been interviewed this time around, and then one, Judge Thomas Hardiman, from the last time around. But the truth is, we don't know exactly what's going on in President Trump's head at this point, do we? Yeah, right. Did I really even ask that?
Well, I was going to say, boy, is that a straight line? We don't know what's going on in President Trump's head. Well, look, the fact is that we kind of think we know who the four are. We think it's Amy Coney Barrett. We think it's Brett Kavanaugh. We think it's Raymond Kethledge. We also think it's Thomas Hardiman, who's a late addition to the list. These are all conservative judges who have pluses and minuses. I mean, of course, we could have a surprise, but look, Neil Gorsuch was not unpredictable last year when Trump picked him. And, you know, you always think about whether Donald Trump is a true conservative or not. Well, I think it's clear that the reason that conservatives stayed with him and the reason why evangelicals are still so high on him, the reason Republicans are still high on him, polls show that aside from George W. Bush in the aftermath of 9/11, Trump's numbers among Republicans are rocking high. So for all the controversies he's done, he's very popular with Republicans. But the reason Republicans are staying with him is exactly moments like this, that he will pick a conservative to the Supreme Court, unlike what Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama would have done. Barack Obama didn't even get his choice, didn't even get hearings for his choice of Merrick Garland in 2016. That's another story that Democrats are still fighting about. But these are the reasons why Donald Trump is so popular with conservatives. A court decision, a court appointment like this will be, you know, instrumental and consequential far longer, once after Trump leaves the White House.
What do you think of the process that got us to this point? And that raises the Federalist Society, which is a national organization of conservative lawyers. And the Federalist Society created this list that the president is working from. How is that process, by your measure, as a political junkie?
Well, it's probably unprecedented. I mean, I don't remember any group really focused heavily on naming judges, not only to the U.S. Supreme Court, but to the federal courts around the country. And, you know, this is exactly what, if you're an ideologue, this is what you should be doing. I'm surprised liberals are not this. I don't think there's a group on the liberal segment of a sector of things that's comparable to the Federalist Society. But basically, they feel, I mean, they've been feeling this for nearly 50 years, going back to the Earl Warren Court, where for the longest time, many courts, and certainly the Ninth Circuit in California is a perfect example, that many courts were seen as very liberal. The Supreme Court was seen as very liberal. So they knew from the beginning that regardless of who the president was, we'll come up with this, you know, we'll work on these identifying and recruiting conservative judges for the federal judiciary and the U.S. Supreme Court. They've done a great job. Obviously, President Trump took its findings and suggestions very seriously with the Gorsuch pick, and that certainly seems to be the case with the pick to replace Justice Kennedy.
So now we have these four candidates, all who have pros and cons for why they should be chosen or not chosen, and it's been quite a debate over the weekend, over the past couple days. I guess it's a process of splitting hairs for a lot of people, because once someone is chosen, there's going to be some coming together on the conservative side to support any one person. The question is, can any one person get all the Republican votes needed?
Well, that is a very important question, especially in a Senate that is basically 50-49, considering that John McCain is too ill to vote. So it's 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats, which means one Republican defection. Let's just say Susan Collins of Maine or Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, both pro-choice Republicans. If one of them vote no, you know, theoretically the nomination could go down to defeat. Of course, on the other hand, you have some Democrats in pro-Trump states like Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota and Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, who are all up for re-election this year, and they're under a tremendous pressure from conservatives to vote for the Trump court. For all the thinking about, wow, maybe Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski could vote no, they always seem to talk a good game about standing up to conservatives, and then ultimately they vote for the Trump and other Republican nominees. They both voted for Neil Gorsuch, and did those three Democrats I just mentioned. So Amy Coney Barrett seems to be very, very conservative. She seems to be among the four. She seems to be the most likely to rule against any, if there's a vote on this, any decision on Roe versus Wade decision. She seems very, very socially conservative about this. The others, less so. But again, you know, as I said, Susan Collins says she's very concerned about the future of Roe. Whether she votes no on anything, it remains to be seen.
Well, there is that aspect of whether Amy Coney Barrett will be held as a nominee for the time when Ruth Bader Ginsburg decides to retire or step down for some reason.
That's my Yeah, that's my guess too.
I think, first of all,
it seems like the favorite is Brett Kavanaugh. Yeah. The argument against Brett Kavanaugh, of course, is that he has a history of working for the Bush administration. And you know how Trump feels about anything related to the Bush administration. He abhors it. In a speech last week in Montana, remarkably or maybe not remarkably, President Trump mocked George H.W. Bush for his 1,000 points of light. I don't know. The guy is 94 years old. I don't know why he's mocking him, what the point of that is. But if there's a bad thing about Kavanaugh, it's the fact that he spent time working for George W. Bush. And that's why I'm kind of wondering if Thomas Hardiman is a late name, a late suggestion to the list. He was the runner-up to Gorsuch last year. He served on the court with Trump's sister, who's a federal court judge in Philadelphia. Don't dismiss Hardiman's chances. I think in some ways he'd be more acceptable to many so-called moderates than Kavanaugh. But, I mean, other than somebody like, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, who I think, as you say, is probably going to be held should Ruth Bader Ginsburg ever leave the court, I kind of think it's Kavanaugh or Hardiman.
You didn't mention that Judge Brett Kavanaugh worked for Kenneth Starr. So there's a long paper trail that could be a factor here.
And not only did he work for Kenneth Starr, he talked about the things where you can impeach a president. And of course, and for Democrats who have these dreams of impeaching Donald Trump, they may throw back Kavanaugh's words about, wait a second, if you don't like this about Bill Clinton, how can you like this about Donald Trump? So, I mean, again, Kavanaugh seems to be the conventional wisdom favorite here, but again, I don't dismiss Hardiman. I think he has a great story, a great personal story. We'll just see what happens. But, you know, the way Trump loves the drama. He loves reality TV. Ultimately, it's not going to really make a big difference. I mean, you think of George H.W. Bush when he picked David Souter to the Supreme Court. That right. turned out to be a disaster yeah. for conservatives. Souter turned out to be a liberal justice. But I don't think any of the four potentials that Donald Trump is looking at, it could possibly be another David Souter.
Could I quickly get your thought about the fact that the president is saying he wants someone in place for the start of the new high court session, which is October, and the Democrats actually want the process delayed until after the November elections, though who yeah. knows whether they'd actually be able to do that?
Well, no, they won't, of course. I mean, look, the Democrats are still steaming about what happened to Merrick Garland in 2016. Not only did he not get a vote, he didn't get a hearing. And so they say, well, if you want to be fair, you should wait until after the election, because that seemed to be the so-called reasoning of Mitch McConnell to hold off on Merrick Garland. But it's not going to happen. I don't think the Democrats are going to win control of the Senate, but just to be safe, I know that the Republicans are going to do whatever they can to push the vote before the election. And that seems interesting in deciding why Kennedy decided to retire before the elections and not after. I mean, if he were not Trump or if he tried to kind of hurt Trump's chances of getting a very conservative justice, he could have waited until after the election to announce his retirement. So, look, I think either way it's going to be a conservative, and the vote will happen before the election, even though the Democrats, you know, Chuck Schumer said, well, why don't you name Merrick Garland to unite the country? It would unite the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, but it wouldn't unite the country.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie. So, Ken, in the next minute or so, let's go through a couple other topics. I know that Scott Pruitt resigning is kind of being lost in all the actions surrounding the Supreme Court. Otherwise, that would be a very big headline and a big story.
It is and it isn't. I mean, the fact that, you know, you talk about Trump trying to drain the swamp. I mean, Scott Pruitt was Mr. Swamp himself with all the ethics and conflicts of interest and ethical questions. But ultimately, replacing Scott Pruitt with his deputy does not change the philosophy, the programs at the Environmental Protection Agency. And I put environmental protection in quotes because clearly the policy is less government regulation, less protection of water, clean water and clean air. So Scott Pruitt is gone. I mean, a big embarrassment for the Trump administration is gone, but the policies don't change.
A judge upheld California's so-called sanctuary state law. As you can guess, that was a big story out here.
it is a big story. And what people don't seem to remember, or maybe they do remember, but the judge who decided that is a George W. Bush appointee. Judge Mendez was appointed by Bush in 2007. I mean, obviously, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is not happy with California. It's basically two different ways of looking at immigration policy in this country. California, which supports the sanctuary policies and allowing them to not have to work with the U.S. Justice Department on immigration, and a very angry Jeff Sessions and Trump, who feel that they're violating the law. So I mean, ultimately, I think what Mendez is saying is that forget about sanctuary policy. The real answer is Congress has got to fix this immigration policy, and so they can't. So one size would fit all, but right now Congress seems completely unable to do that.
Looking ahead, we're going to be talking about the president and the NATO meeting and the Putin summit. And I think the expectations are high there, maybe not as high as the Singapore summit with North Korea, but certainly a meeting of these two world leaders has a lot of possibilities. Let's say it that way.
Well, not only possibilities, that what the fear so many people have is that what President Trump is going to do or say leading up to the Putin summit, and that is the meeting with NATO. And of course, the president loves to criticize NATO members. He says that they don't pay for their own defense. They don't pay their fair share. And it's very discouraging if you're an American ally to hear the president attack the leaders of all these countries and yet nary a critical word about Putin. So, again, if the president goes into this NATO summit critical of Britain and Germany and France and Canada and all these American allies, and then goes in with a bear hug for Vladimir Putin, it sends a signal once again that weakening the NATO alliance is exactly what Putin wants to see. And if that's what's going to happen, if that's what President Trump's goal is, then you just wonder about the future of NATO, certainly for the rest of Trump's term as president.
Honestly, though, Ken, you know what the world is watching right now is what's happening.
Alan Dershowitz.
What's happening in a cave in Thailand. That's what we're all watching, right?
You know something, and isn't this, I think we are so desperate for good news and happy news. And this, it's like somebody, I think it was Scott Simon on Twitter, who said it's like the moon landing, like we're glued to it. Mm. And we should be. It feels good. It gives you hope. All the terrible yelling outside, you could just block it away watching these rescues. Of course, it's not over. I think 9 have been rescued
eight.
So far.
Eight so far.
Eight is it four today?
Four, and then the ninth. Coach are still to be rescued, right?
I know, and we're just watching. Then at least we're all on the same side of one story.
Yeah.
And it's certainly this story. It's a great story.
Yeah, I'm with you on
it's
that.
It's a hopeful story, I should say.
All right, so big news tonight, and we'll follow it up the rest of the week, and we'll talk to you next Monday, okay, Ken?
Thank you so much, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin. He is the political junkie. You can find more at capradio.org/insight. And again, NPR's live coverage and analysis starts at 6 o'clock in the West here on Cap Radio and at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. NPR will have live coverage of President Trump's announcement of his nominee to fill the vacancy of retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy at 6 p.m. Pacific time. It's on Cap Radio and at capradio.org. Congresswoman Doris Matsui stopped by our studio last week, and we talked about a number of subjects, including Justice Kennedy's decision. The Matsuis and the Kennedys share roots in Sacramento. They've been longtime friends, and members of each family have had Washington, D.C. career paths. So the Congresswoman shared some memories of Justice Kennedy's Supreme Court transition.
My late husband, Bob, spoke at his confirmation hearing and also was there when President Reagan nominated him. He came, in fact, Tony mentioned this to me, that it was a snowy day. And they called Bob to come to the White House, and Bob had to go through the snow to get to the White House to witness, you know, President Reagan nominating him. the thing about Justice Kennedy is that he is a Sacramentan. He's a McClatchy grad. Bob went to McClatchy. Bob was good friends with Justice Kennedy's younger brother, Timmy. And there's a group of people in Sacramento went to McClatchy. Tony Kennedy was one of them. Sacramento values in a sense of being part of a community, understanding what it means to make sure that the community is whole, you understand your neighbors. And he brought that to, you know, his career. And, you know, he's always somebody who believed in the individual, individual rights. He was a Republican. He's a Republican. He's a conservative. But he also understood the human side of things, too. If you look at his career, I mean, I don't think he ever believed he'd be the swing vote. It happened to be that way. I think he took a lot of time deciding on what he wanted to do. Our family connections, I look at him and realize that, you know, he is really someone that Sacramento should be proud of. There were decisions that we didn't agree with, but a lot of the big decisions were so important to this country. My son, he was a clerk to Justice Kennedy, too. So, you know, it's like the time passes, you know? You realize, my goodness, he really deserves his time to do things with his wife, Mary. He will not stay still. He's still going to be very active, probably coming back to McGeorge from time to time. He loves that. And so, you know, he'll be in Washington. He has his home there. His kids are on the East Coast. But things have really changed. Now we have a challenge now because there's not going to be a Justice Kennedy on the court. And we're hopeful that whoever comes on the court might come with an open mind. We're not too sure of that, obviously. And that's the one reason why a lot of us look upon this with some sadness.
How intense will the battle be for his replacement?
Well, I think it's going to be quite intense. The Republican Party has been much more intense about the Supreme Court and when they have a battle than I think the Democrats have. But in this particular case, what happened to Merrick Garland when he got nominated last time, he didn't even have a courtesy of being able to visit with some of the senators, didn't get a hearing, and he was stalled. I can understand why the senators, Democratic senators, want to see if they can possibly have the American people decide on this by maybe not having this move as quickly as Leader McConnell wants it to move.
And not till after the election.
Yes, right. Because that was the standard that was put forth by the Leader McConnell himself with Merrick Garland. So, you know, we don't know where it's going to be, but I really believe if you look at the importance of the Supreme Court on healthcare, civil rights, women's rights, immigration, and in a sense of who we are as Americans, it's important. And I think the Democrats firmly realize how important it is. And I think that they're going to do what they need to do in order to ensure that they at least challenge and question what kind of justice is going to be there for, as President Trump says, the next 35, 45 years. That's a long time.
Do you think the process should be delayed until after the November election?
Well, if I had it my way, I'd say yes. But I'm a member of the House, right?
Right.
The senators have a challenge there. You know, the Senate used to be a place where there's supposed to be much more collegiality, but I think it's been very difficult for senators who really like that collegiality to continue. And I think there's one way to be open-minded about things. And if they listen to each other a lot more, it would be helpful to this country.
You're listening to my conversation with Congresswoman Doris Matsui. It was recorded last week. She was back in Sacramento for the holiday. And because it was almost July 4th, I asked her how she sees Americans today, whether she thinks the definition of being American is changing.
I believe today that people are confronting their beliefs, perhaps outdated beliefs, and trying to figure out where we go And I don't think that's a bad thing. But I also believe that we should do it with civility and respect and understanding. Because many times when we talk with other people, listen, we find that we're more alike than not alike. I believe that's really the essence of who we are as Americans. We're always striving to understand and be accepting and trying to listen and, in a way, demonstrate hopefully the best of ourselves.
Will you share with me some of what you've been thinking and feeling during this time of families being detained at the border, families being separated?
This is almost universal as far as what most people feel as parents. We've all had the sense of, at one point in time, we're in the grocery store in a park, all of a sudden for maybe 1 or 2 seconds, you looked at something else and your child somehow escaped somewhere. You're just feeling like, oh my goodness, what happened here? And you find your child, but that sense of losing that separation, and the child themselves, when all of a sudden they wandered off and they're crying, and that fear of not having their parent there, that is universal,
no,
I believe.
Panic, actually.
It is panic. Yeah. And what I saw here, too, is I think everybody has their own stories and their own history. What I saw there was also, in a sense, not only the separation, but the fact that it goes against who we are as a country and Americans. And what we saw there with the apprehension of these people at the borders and the separation of the families and putting them in cages where they were separated because of the zero tolerance, then what's the next step, right? Because you still have to go through a process here. These people have to go through trials and all of that. So how long is this detention going to be? And then you see the pictures of places that they're going to place these people, these families, on perhaps military bases. And you looked at those places and they look eerily like some of the pictures I've seen during the internment. And you look at that and you think, wow, this is not a path we want to go down at all. How long is a detention? We never knew also in the internment, right? And these people aren't citizens, but they have every right to not be detained in that manner. And we even knew during the Japanese American internment, these were citizens, and yet they were detained. So if citizens could be detained that way, what about these other people who are not citizens or immigrants?
You have been open about your family history in the internment camp. For you in particular, is there a sense of connection with some of the children who have been separated? And I guess I've never heard from you specifically what your earliest memories or awareness were, what stories you were told about the very beginnings of your own life.
Keep in mind that for me, my parents were American citizens. They were not married at the time. They came from different places. My father was in Los Angeles. My mother was a little town called Reedley. And they ended up in the same camp. Ultimately, they met and they married. I was born in an internment camp in Poston, Arizona, at the end of World War II. So, you know, I probably spent maybe 3 or 4 months in camp before they were allowed to leave camp and went back to their home. So I didn't have any memories at all. And my parents really didn't want me to be burdened, I believe, by the internment, feeling defensive or any way not American. So we didn't talk about it at all. You know, we're all American. You know, we went to school and we participated in all the activities and really had an American life. And it was only until I really got to college and went to Berkeley that you started realizing and hearing about things that were happening or had happened. And you remember some conversations, but you felt that that was in the past and your parents never brought it to the dinner table. So we never really discussed it in a deep way. But I think my generation realized that this was not right. We're American citizens. and put into camps without a trial, without representation, was bad.
That was part of my conversation with California Congresswoman Doris Matsui. We've posted the bigger conversation online. It includes our talk about healthcare issues and her very prominent work on the Affordable Care Act. You can find it at capradio.org/insight. By the way, I did ask whether she thinks of retirement, and she said without missing a beat, nope, I'm going to keep going. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Over the weekend, Governor Brown declared a state of emergency in Santa Barbara County, San Diego County, and Siskiyou County because of wildfires. A firefighter in one of those battles was hospitalized for burns. We're going to get an update now from the Deputy Chief of CAL FIRE, Scott McClain. He's on the phone with us. Hello. Good to have you back on the program, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you give me the update on Brandon Feller? I guess he's the firefighter who was taken to the UC Davis Burn Center.
That is correct. He has been released from the hospital and is now spending time with his family.
So he was injured in the Klamathon fire. That one started July 5th. What's happening now with that fire? And I know a number of homes were destroyed, so can you run down the details for me?
The homes, as far as the amount of homes destroyed at this point in time, I don't have an accurate tally of those. The fire has grown to 35,250 acres, but it pretty much held where it was during the course of the night.
I think you're getting a couple phone. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can hear that you're juggling phone calls as you're talking to us. I appreciate how crazy this day must be.
Yes, and you can imagine how busy it is.
Okay, am I okay continuing with this conversation, or do you need to be off the phone?
We're taking care of it. I can imagine busy this morning with a lot of different things going on.
Yeah. Deputy Chief, can you hear me right now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, just give me some overall statistics. How many crews are out there on how many different fire lines?
Well, on the Klamathon, we're looking at roughly 2,700 individuals. On the county fire, which has been burning for over a week, we're looking at 2,600 individuals assigned to these incidents. And that doesn't count the fires that are taking place from the Oregon border to the Mexican border.
Yeah, going to the CAL FIRE website, there are a lot of red symbols on the map today.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, Sacramento in the Northern California area. I think the Pawnee Fire is 100% contained now, but
yeah.
What else is happening? The Valley Fire and some of the others in the area.
Right. So we're looking at the Grant Fire down in Alameda County, 600 acres, but it's 90% contained as of this morning.
Okay.
The fire in Contra Costa County, it finaled about 100% this morning. It was 56 acres. We discussed the county fire. It was 90,000 as of this morning, 288 acres, but it's 73% contained, which is good news. They had a large burning operation during the course of the weekend that took care of a lot of the situation. Over in the community of Plymouth, southeast of Sacramento, 790 acres burned just like that. It is now 99% contained, which is really good news. The Valley Fire down south in San Bernardino County is up to 1,348 acres, and it's grown from 5% to 13% containment. Another fire down there, the West Fire, 505 acres, but it's 92% contained. And then lastly, one fire I want to bring up that's kind of an indicator of what we're dealing with on all these fires, the Holiday Fire.
Right.
It burned 100 acres. It's 90% contained, but it destroyed a lot of homes and structures just like that. These fires are not hesitating. Once they start, they spread very rapidly this year.
How does this early July compare to fire seasons at this point in the past?
Well, let's take season out of the fire season part, because the fires are year-round the last several years. And that's what we're contending with, just because of the climate that we're dealing with. The vegetation does not have that recoup of moisture. 129 million dead trees in the state, as I sit here today, that we're having to contend with as well.
You're also talking about jumping on these small fires very quickly and the containment rate, even though some do explode and get out of control, as we saw with the Pawnee Fire. It seems like the CAL FIRE response is either faster or with more resources this year. Is either count true?
We are paying attention, as we always do. The foundation of our responses has been laid for many years on how we respond to these fires. So we have the ability to adapt to these incidents quickly with more resources if need be, depending on where they are, of course. A lot of these major fires have grown due to the inaccessibility of trying to get our troops into those areas. 95% of these fires are 10% or 10 acres or less is what we've been able to keep them at.
Yeah.
95% of these fires are human caused.
Well, we appreciate your availability. As I said, I know it gets hectic, but to be able to check in with you and have everybody hear where the key fire lines are is really important. So, Chief McClain, I'm very grateful for your time today.
And I apologize for all the chaos first thing, but I appreciate the time given to be on your show.
Well, you gave us a window into real life. We all understand that. So thanks very much.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Good luck out there to you and all the firefighters. That is CAL FIRE's Deputy Chief Scott McClain. And you can continue to follow the fire coverage at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A new book titled Eagle and Crane might make your summer reading list for a few reasons. By the way, it should make your summer reading list. It's a historical mystery set in Newcastle and many California towns that you might know are mentioned. The story unfolds in the early 1940s, just after the Great Depression, but before and during the earliest time of the Japanese internment and around, of course, the time of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The storyline centers around people in a traveling air show, a barnstormer show, as it was called then. And when a crash happens, we become connected to the law enforcement types who come in to investigate. This is the third novel by Suzanne Rendell, who grew up in Sacramento. She is the author of Three Martini Lunch and The Other Typist. Suzanne will be at Face in a Book in El Dorado Hills tonight at 6:30. And I'm so happy that she's here in the studio with us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So congratulations on your success as a writer.
Thank you so much.
And with that, I have to talk about The Other Typist first, because how many languages has it been translated now into?
I think we're at 15 right now.
And the actress Keira Knightley had optioned this to be both producer and to star in the story. I haven't seen an update recently, so what's happening in the pipeline of moving that story along?
Yeah, so Keira Knightley optioned it in conjunction with Fox Searchlight Pictures. And recently, in fact, the previous summer, they went ahead, renewed the option, and Ridley Scott's production company, Scott Free Films, has joined on. So now it's Fox Searchlight, Keira Knightley, and Scott Free Films, and they hired a screenwriter. So I'm actually very eager to read a screenplay and find out what happens in the film version, if it's the same as the book or not.
How did your writing career take shape here? Did you go to high school in Sacramento?
I did. I went to two high schools, Valley High in Sacramento in the Elk Grove School District, and then Del Oro when my parents moved up to the Rockland area. I always loved writing and books. I didn't honestly think, though, that that would be a viable career. I was looking for something that, I don't know, had health insurance and regular hours. And so
you were a young person already thinking about that.
Well, I think my parents were thinking about that for me.
Responsible.
So, yeah, I didn't necessarily set out on this path, but as I gravitated towards books and literature time and time again, it led me down the road to get my PhD, which I recently completed, and then to work in publishing for a little while in New York. And I think probably working in publishing is when I started to really get the idea of like what writing a book looked like, what the shape of a book was like, and what it took to sit down and write a book. And then from there, I got lucky and got my first book contract, and I've really been, you know, in love with this job ever since.
Well, readers were in love with The Other Typist. That was the first one. And it's set in the 1920s. I recall an interview when you said you sort of heard the narrator's voice and the story unfolded as you listened to that lead character's voice. So let's talk now about Eagle and Crane. Did it evolve the same way? Did you hear a voice?
A little different, because The Other Typist is a very first-person novel, and the main character, her first-person voice is a little unreliable. So as I was writing that one, I was more curious to find out where she was going. I felt like she was leading me through the plot. Eagle and Crane is a little different. It's told in the third person, and part of that reason is because it takes on several different characters. And as well as like one of the main characters is Lewis Thorne, the all-American sort of boy from Newcastle.
He's the eagle.
He's the eagle of Eagle and Crane. The other character, main character, is Harry Yamada. And the Yamadas are a Japanese family. And I was more interested in being able to move between these perspectives and also maybe a little cautious to speak in the first person for the Yamada family.
So Harry is Crane in Eagle and Crane. You come at this with some interesting family history, which includes Barbara Matsui. We heard in the show earlier from Doris Matsui.
Right.
And Barbara is her sister-in-law, actually.
That's correct, yes. She was an inspiration to me. My mother was friends with Barbara when they were young women. And she was probably my favorite of my mother's friends. I loved spending time with her. As a child, I was difficult not to notice the fact that Barbara was legally blind. And when I asked my mother why Barbara was legally blind, she explained to me that Barbara had been born in one of the internment camps, actually at Tule Lake, I believe. And while pregnant, her mother didn't have access to great health care in the camps, and the conditions in the camps led them to her contracting German measles. And the German measles is why Barbara was born legally blind. And I think that left an impression on me as a young child to try to fathom that these camps had actually happened, and they'd happened here in California, and they'd affected people that I knew and loved. So that impression led me to kind of revisit it when I came to write this story, and I was trying to write a very Northern California story. I realized that this was part of that story.
That combined with a lot of aviation history, your grandfather, your father, your mother. So weave some of that in, and then we'll come back around to the storyline of Eagle and Crane.
So the aviation history. Well, my grandfather was a flight instructor for World War II pilots. And then my father was an Air Force captain, and he flew F-111s. And then my mother, I suppose she figured that if her father could do it and her husband could do it, then why not her? And she took flying lessons and got her wings. So I come from a family of aviators, and I was taken to quite a lot of air shows as a child. What's interesting is the fact that I have a fear of flying.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's written a little bit into the storyline of one of the characters, too.
That part was a little easier to write, the character with a fear of flying. I definitely, if that's genetic, the aviation gene, I didn't get that. But I'm definitely interested in it, and I was interested in this period of history leading up to when the book takes place, the teens and the 20s leading up through the 30s, when people would put on these great barnstorming acts and have flying circuses. And the stuntmen would go wing walking. And it just sounded incredible and sort of nostalgic.
Now we're coming to all the mystery and thrill of Eagle and Crane, because the backdrop is very serious and it is historical. And you had to do a lot of research to put this very structured but twisting, turning, full of great character story into this book. So do you want to give a little more of the overall synopsis?
Sure. Yeah. So as you already mentioned, the title, Eagle and Crane, is named for the two main characters. They are Lewis Thorne and Harry Yamada, and they're basically performing stunts in this flying circus act. And pilots tend to give each other nicknames or call signs. And in the course of the novel, the pilots kind of give Lewis and Harry a couple of nicknames that have slightly racist tones. The pilots dub Lewis Eagle, as in the All-American Eagle, and they dub Harry Crane, thinking the crane is a very Japanese bird. But instead of resisting these nicknames, Lewis and Harry actually embrace them, and they use the Eagle and Crane theme to put on a more spectacular costumed choreographed show. And it starts doing very well. In fact, they garner interest from Hollywood. But then, as this does take place during the late 30s and early 40s, the bombing of Pearl Harbor interrupts everything. And Harry Yamada and his family are basically obligated to go into an internment camp. And a lot of Japanese families who were interned sometimes looked for a friend they could sign their property over to hold for them. And in this case, the Yamada family, they look to Lewis to act as the guardian of their land as they go into internment. And part of the mystery that you mention is sort of the question of how good of a friend Lewis is to Harry, and exactly what will shape up as the Yamadas go through this darker period in their lives, and Lewis sort of holds more of the power.
I like the complication and the weight of them trying to navigate their relationship, which sometimes is a friendship, sometimes not, and very heavily influenced by each of their families.
Yeah, it's sort of the fox and the hound model of friendship,
right,
as I like
right.
to think of it. The Thorne family has carried a grudge against the Yamada family, particularly of the Yamada family's prosperity. And so Lewis has actually been raised to avoid Harry. They made friends as young children, and Lewis's family was not having it. So the friendship that they forge later in life as young men and in the course of this book is sort of a push-pull. It's very fraught, and they're both competitive as well as maybe friends underneath it all.
You're listening to Suzanne Rendell. She has a new historical mystery titled Eagle and Crane. She's going to be at Face in a Book in El Dorado Hills outside of Sacramento tonight at 6:30. She grew up in Sacramento, as you heard her say, moved to New York, and now you're back, at least in Northern California.
We're now back in San Francisco.
Why is it important to you that people hold present the era that your book was written in? And some of the history that is true.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I started writing this book, I mean, it takes a while to write a book and for a book to go through the publishing process. And when I started writing this book, the political climate was very different. Obama was still in office, and some of the recent immigration politics hadn't yet transpired. And so as I was editing it, some of these things started taking shape, the more current events that you might be referencing. And so it began to take on a different feel for me as I wrote it. I remember in the beginning worrying about writing the scenes in the Japanese internment camps and worrying about trying to make that immediate enough for my reader and felt enough for my reader. I was worried they might not be able to connect with it. And as sort of recent events have unfolded, I feel like there's so much of a parallel there for a reader to now feel is very palpable.
Well, you've accomplished a couple things here. It's a fast and satisfying read. The structure is great. The characters are clear. And I say put it on the summer reading list because even though your themes and your history are heavy, there is a lightness. There is an air show, barnstormer right. quality to it. And I think it's a good reminder of a different time, a different place. And I'm really happy to meet you. I'm sorry we haven't met with your previous books, but let's do this again with the next one.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Suzanne. Again, Suzanne Rindell will be at Face in a Book in El Dorado Hills tonight at 6:30. The new book is Eagle and Crane, and there's more at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. NPR's special coverage begins tonight at 6 p.m. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.